I'm okay now. All right, verse 9c here, the latter part of this verse, and verse 10. Why is the law made? Well, it's made for these three general groups of people. And now Paul gets very specific and deals with individual areas of sinning. Again, the tending to be the more shocking sins, as we recognize that Paul does paint a pretty bad picture of unbelievers. But these things are characteristic of him. It's not as though he makes these things up either. He intentionally picks the things that are some of the worst things they do. For those who kill their fathers or mothers. Actually, you have, for those who kill their fathers is actually a dative. All these are datives because it completes the thought back. The law is made for, and then these datives complete the thought of who it's made for. The law is for father killers. Literally, what you have in the Greek is patroleos, P-A-T-R-O-L-O-A-S. Patroloas, I'm sorry. And that word just means one who kills his father. It comes from a pater, the word for father, and then the word for killing. And then the next one is one word also, and it's matroloos, just the different prefix, because this deals with mater, which is mother, and murderers. And then you got androphanos, A-N-D-R-O-P-H-O-N-O-S. Phoneo means to kill or to murder. Andros, it comes from oner, the word for man. And so it means men killers. And again, we make a distinction between legitimate killing, say in warfare or self-defense and that kind of thing, and then non-legitimate killing. This is non-legitimate killing, murder. And immoral men. Literally, you got pornos, which is the word for immorality, literally a male prostitute. But it comes to be used in a broader sense of anyone that's engaged in illicit sexual activity of any kind. Obviously, we get our word pornography from this, which is graphos for writing, and pornos, which deals with sexual immorality. So you have here literally a male prostitute, but it is the word is understood in a broader sense, not just a male prostitute. And homosexuals. This word is one of the cruxes of the arguments in the modern pro-homosexual movement. Arsenokoites, A-R-S-E-N-O-K-O-I-T-E-S. Two times this word's used in the Bible. Literally, it comes from koite, which means to sleep with someone. And it has the idea, we get our word coitus from it, so it's not just sleeping in a bed. It refers to sexual sleeping. And then the word arsene is not on air. It's actually a stronger term, and this focuses on specifically on the maleness of a person as opposed to the femaleness, things that constitute a male as opposed to female, and it includes, but not limited to, the sex organs. So this literally means to bed a male for sex. Now, the modern pro-homosexual movement says that's not what this word means at all. This word doesn't mean that. This word means something different. Well, coite means the bed, and specifically, coite means the marriage bed. As a matter of fact, it's used in that regard in, if you look in Hebrews, I don't think I put the verse in here, so hopefully I can find it quickly. But heck, even if I put the verses in there, half the time they're not right, so I probably got just as good a shot up here as I do in the study. It's Hebrews 13, I believe. Hebrews 13:4. First, you have a deal with marriage, which uses the word gamos, which is a different term, but it refers to, you know, what we understand normal marriage to be. Marriage is honorable. Let it be held in honor, as it says here, among all. And the bed, there's koite. And it refers to, let the marriage bed be undefiled, i.e., no immorality in the marital relationship. That's clearly what that verse is teaching. And so when they get into this verse, they want to say, well, you know, that term, you know, bed, that's really not clear. Oh, it's clear. It's just that they want to reject what the text obviously says. And one of the first things you have to do in terms of defining a word is you have to go to its etymology. Where did it come from? What does this word mean? And if you watch, I don't watch it because I can't take too much of it, but like if you watch spelling bees, like the big thing they have, you know, it's on SportsCenter or ESPN. Now, when did spelling become a sport? But whatever, I don't want to get off on that. But you watch it and they'll say, what's the etymology? What language is it derived from? Why? Because that number one, is very important to help you figure out how to spell it. But number two, to know what the word actually means, you have to study etymology first, where the word itself comes from. So this word means exactly what it says here. It's those who bed males. And it's in a vice list, so this is viewed as a bad thing. There's no one in their right mind that looks at this list and says killing of fathers and killing of mothers and murderers is good things that we ought to all be doing. It says it's just the opposite of that. So you have here to bed a male. Then you have kidnappers, is andrapodistes. Again, another compound, andrapodistes. This means literally a slave trader, and it includes those that kidnap people and sell them into slavery. It comes from foot, and again, on air, man, and the idea of the word is footman, which doesn't make, you know, how did they get to slave trader from footman? It has the idea of those who subvert people's lives, and in this case, it's very well translated by the idea of kidnapping. Kidnapping and liars. This is Seustes, Seutes, and that means exactly that, literally one that breaks faith, a false or a lying man. And perjurers is Epiorkos, Epiorkos, one who swears falsely. And we understand what a perjury is in a legal setting. And predominantly, this focuses more on legal things, of course, when you get into perjury. Lying would be the more general term. A perjury is just a specific form of lying. It's lying in a specific environment, whereas lying can be done, you know, sort of anywhere. And perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. And is chi, and then you've got here a third-class condition, or a first-class condition, and if anything. You've got the conjunction I, which introduces the conditional clause, and then the indefinite pronoun tis, if anything. And then you got the word heteros here, the adjective, H-E-T-E-R-O-S. And this word means to be different, to be in conflict, we might say, to be different from, but not just different in the sense, you know, you can have two things that are different, and they're not necessarily good or bad different, they're just different. Okay, but in this case, in the context here, Paul is saying anything that's different from the kind of teaching I do, if you deviate from what I'm teaching and you advocate these types of things, this is, and so here he uses kind of a catch-all. And if anything is different from the teaching, sound teaching. And so what, and the New American Standard sort of understood that different here is used in a pejorative sense. And so they translated it contrary, that it's not just different, it's opposed to sound teaching. If you advocate these types of activities, you are opposed categorically to sound teaching, whether people want to admit it or not. So the pro-homosexual lobby is opposed to sound doctrine. I can make that categorical statement just based on this verse, because it is here in this vice list. And why do I settle on that? Because that is one of the huge issues in churches all over the world at this point. Whole denominations are wrestling with, can we endorse this? Can we embrace it? Do we want homosexuals in the ministry? Do we want to ordain them? Lucky they don't live under the Mosaic Law, because we stone them under the Mosaic Law. And they're taken out of society as the blight on society that they are, unfortunately. But we don't have that in the church age. We're not provided the right to capital punishment and all that. So we let the law deal with them. God has to deal with them. And that's one of the things, you know, in a Christian life, part of faith wrestling stuff is recognizing, you know, some of this is just out of my hands. A lot of it is out of my hands. There's actually very little I can control. Really, the only thing I can really control is me. Other people have to live their own lives and make their own decisions, good, bad, or otherwise, stupid ones, good ones, bad decisions. You got to allow them to make them. You got to give them freedom. So here, this is, all these things in this list are opposed to sound teaching. Didaskalia is the word for teaching, D-I-D-A-S-K-A-L-I-A. which means teaching or instruction. It includes both the act of teaching, like what I'm doing now, I'm teaching, and it includes what I'm teaching, the content. The word covers both things. And then you got this qualifying adjective here. Well, actually, in this case, it's a participle that functions as an adjective. Hugaino. H-U-G-A-I-N-O. Now, hugaino means physically healthy. I mean, we all know what that word means in terms of physical. Like, are you sick today? No, I'm fine. I'm physically healthy. And so in doctrine, it means to be sound, to be free from mixed in error. And so some of the things you have to deal with are, number one, purity of doctrine. This is one of the things Paul will deal with Timothy about later, is that you've got to make sure that your teaching, as much as you possibly can, is free from error. And nobody has to be perfect. You know, and we say this, and mentally we kind of acknowledge it and we agree with it. But then, really, it boils down to when you don't agree with something I say, you say, well, you know, man, he's messed up there. He needs to be perfect, deep down. But guess what? Nobody can be. At least I've never met anybody that was perfect. So you, as much as possible, the teaching is to be free from this admixture of error, from mixing in opposing concepts. And Paul recognizes there's teaching and then there's sound teaching. So there are various levels of this out there. So if anything else is, as it says here, is opposed, whatever is contrary, and then here you got antichimai, which means, eight times it's used, it means to be laid against, to be an enemy, to be hostile, to be opposed to something. And whatever else of any different kind that's opposed to sound teaching. And so he uses this catch-all to say, look, there's a lot of things out there opposed to sound teaching. This list is not exhaustive. This just sets the tone for the kind of things I teach against, he says. And then he defines sound teaching as being according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. According to is a preposition kata, followed by the accusative. And it means conforming to a standard or according to a standard of the gospel. Euangelion. U-N-G-E-L. Well, actually, E-U-A-N-G-E-L-I-O-N. This word means good news or a good announcement. That's what the gospel is. It's good news. Mankind is in a state of hostility and alienation from God. And the gospel comes in and says, I will give you salvation as a free gift. That's good news. What do I have to do? Nothing. It's free. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. That is simple. That is free. That is good news. And we should never lose sight of the fact that we've got the best news this planet's ever heard. Men may not want to avail themselves of it. They may foolishly fritter it away. But we've still got it. The gospel is good news. The glorious gospel here, as he calls it, he qualifies it with the adjective doxa. And it's glorious because of the fact that this proceeds from God himself. We didn't make up the gospel. It's our job not to make up anything, yet just to reflect what the gospel itself maintains and what the Bible itself maintains. We don't have to ad lib. The glorious gospel of the blessed God. Makarios is the word blessed. And that means literally one who has felicity, one who is spiritually happy and prosperous. How do you think God lives from day to day? He doesn't live like we live. God lives in a state of perpetual blessedness, a state of perpetual glory. God doesn't have up days and down days. God is constantly, always in this state of felicity, of happiness. The world hates God. The world rejects God. Does that bother God? No. God doesn't let it bother him. In some ways, God lives above it all. And this is what eternal life is all about. This is what the life of God in the believer is all about. And in some ways, it's living above it all. It's dealing with things and just say, you know what? At the end of this whole thing, okay, I got my 70 years. Now, I'm 50 or 51. So if I got 70 years, I'm pretty well done. I mean, I've completed the biggest part of my course, most likely. And at the end of it all, what am I going to look back on, and what am I going to be proud of? What am I going to be ashamed of? What am I going to have? At the end of it all, I'm going to live in glory with God. And that the level of that glory is determined at some, you know, level by what I do in phase two. But why do we worry about so many things that really aren't consequential? Really, at the end of it all, at the end of the day, when we're finished, if you get to maturity and you make all the adjustments to God's plan and you finish your course and you get your crown, do you think you're going to care about anything else? No, you're not. And when you stand before the bema seat, are you going to stand there, and if you lose out, are you not going to know that it was your own fault? But nobody, and that's the whole deal of what we try to avoid. We want you to avoid shame at the bema seat. Because your phase two is going to be evaluated. And the things you think are important, you better ask yourself, are these important according to doctrine? What is the real big goal here? What are we shooting for? What are our priorities? How are we going to accomplish the objectives? And if we do accomplish them, you're going to be so ecstatically happy that it's unbelievable. You're going to be so gloriously blessed, it's unbelievable. You're going to live a life in phase two, and phase three, rather, that is beyond what you can even imagine. So you have the glorious gospel, or the gospel of glory, depending on how you want to translate it, of the blessed God, Hotheos, which relative pronoun host is a neuter, because it refers back to gospel, which is a neuter, which I myself have been entrusted. You got ego here used in an emphatic sense. Paul is pointing to his part in all of this. He emphasizes his aspect and his contribution in God's plan. Pistuo is the passive of the verb to believe. And so it comes to have the idea of one whom you would believe, one whom you would trust. Now, why does God trust Paul? That becomes a big question. What do you think the teacher wannabes say about this verse? Well, Paul makes it very plain. God entrusted me with this, and I'm fulfilling my mandate, and I don't really care what anybody else thinks. I've been entrusted by God. I answer to a much higher power and a much higher authority than you do. And ultimately, of course, we all answer to that same authority. But I've been entrusted with this by God. I'm aware of it, and Paul says, and I'm doing my job. And part of it is dealing with stuff like this, some of it not so much fun. One, having demonstrated that the Mosaic law is for the spiritually lawless, Paul now moves to make to specific types of activities that have been prohibited by the law. Two, most sound interpreters have recognized that the vice list that follows is predicated upon the second half of the Decalogue, the second half of the Ten Commandments. Essentially, the first five of the Ten Commandments relate to attitudes and actions toward God, the vertical relationship you have with God. The second half of it deals with the horizontal and deals with your attitudes and all that towards men. And it has to do with stealing, honoring your father and mother, and these types of things. It has to do with the horizontal relationships. Three, as such, it focuses on specific violations of the fifth through ninth commandments, detailing various crimes against one's fellow man. Four, the first two terms denote those that kill their fathers or mothers, which would be the most shocking violation of the fifth commandment, Exodus 20:12. That's something you ought to commit to memory, that anytime you have questions about the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20 is where you want to go. That's where they are recorded. Exodus 20:12. This would be the most shocking violation of honoring your father and mother by killing them. That's not honoring them. Okay, we would understand that. Honor your father and mother that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. So again, the most shocking violation of not honoring them would be, you know, shooting them in the head. And yet, there are people who feel justified in this type of activity. This exists in the human race. I mean, we've had it recently, and I can't remember, but weren't there just several crimes around here in the last 6 or 8 months where people just went in and killed their families, killed their parents? So this happens. And when it happens, of course, society is shocked, but the reality is, this is all in the Bible. We should have been able to figure out it was going to occur. There's nothing new under the sun. Five, that command is broadened in Exodus 21:15 and 17 to include any form of overt dishonor, such as striking one's parents or cursing one's parents. Exodus 21:15, and he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And also verse 17, and he who curses his father or mother shall be surely put to death. And so he deals with verbal hostility, and all of that, and then he deals with physical hostility. So it's broadened there. Sixth, the next group of murderers is somewhat more general and would include any form of hostile or premeditated attacks on people that resulted in their death. Numbers 35, and that, of course, is the next commandment there in 2013, you shall not murder. And again, we make a distinction between self-defense. We make a distinction between killing and warfare. We make a distinction between manslaughter, accidental killing. And we make a distinction between premeditated acts of violence and hostility toward people, where you lie in wait for them and you seek to kill them for whatever purpose, whether it's, in many cases, it's to try to get what they have. Other cases, it's just based on hatred. I hate them, I'm going to kill them. And it's unrestrained hatred taken to its natural limit. The mental attitude sin of hatred leads to murder. That's why it's condemned. Numbers 35, 16 through 21. Here, but if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he struck him down by a stone in his hand, by which he may die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him with a wooden object. Okay, I can hear it now. We've got to outlaw all wooden objects. Wooden objects kill people. No, they don't. He struck him. As a result, he died. He is a murderer. We can, now, see, today we would expand this. If he shoots him with a bazooka so that he dies, he is a murderer. If he stabs him with a knife so that he dies, he is a murderer. If he shoots him with a gun so that he dies, he is a murderer. So the murderer shall surely be put to death. And the blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. Now, this was kind of a cool deal because the closest family member got to go out and kill the murderer. This was part of his responsibility as the part of the next of kin deal. And so if somebody killed somebody in your family, you could go out and avenge it. And before God and be honorable. And see, that's killing that's justified. Capital punishment. That's another form of killing that's justified. And so in our society, of course, they can't make these distinctions anymore because people can't think critically, apparently. They can't see the difference between self-defense and murder, premeditated hostile killing. Can't see the difference between capital punishment and murder, which capital punishment's espoused by the scriptures. And if he pushed him out of hatred or threw something out at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. So you get mad at a guy. You get in a fight with him. This has happened. People get beat up in fights. They get hit in the right place and they die. Guess what? You go to prison. Well, prison. You should die, but we're not going to kill you. But that's the way it should be dealt with. And you know what? One of the things I've seen, you know, I saw this too. I think Charlton Heston said it. He said, you know, one of those old white guys that founded the country, he said, they recognize that an armed society is a polite society. See, you're not going to be prone. You might get mad at me, but you're not going to be prone to jump on me if you think I got a gun and might kill you. You can get mad all you want, but that's going to restrain. You're going to temper that anger with the result that, you know, with the reality that, hey, I could get shot and be dead. And so I'm not advocating that everybody carry guns or any of that. But the fact is, certain things are deterrents to certain actions. And thinking people can see this. Anyone that can think critically can see this. The deterrent of capital punishment stops some people. The threat of punishment stops certain people from doing certain things. And again, we have lots of motivations to obey the Lord, but one of our motivations is the fear of God. If I do certain things, what's God going to do to me? How is God going to react to what I do? Well, that's the fear of God. Pardon me. So here, punishable by death, that's it. You're done. So it's general here. It's more general. And in this chapter, too, and I'm not going to deal with all this, but this chapter also in Numbers makes the deal of the cities of refuge, which is what happens in manslaughter. Now, some cases might be hard to define. If you were on a jury and you heard a case where a person, they were next door neighbors and they bickered back and forth and one of them got mad and they finally they got in a fight and one of them died. What's your sentence? Well, according to the Bible, that's murder. So people say, well, you know, he didn't mean to kill him. Does the Bible say anything here about whether he meant to do it or not? Doesn't address that. It just says, if he does this. So, and obviously a lot of this gets at underlying enmity and hatred that prompts these types of activities. So you got somebody who goes out and drinks till they're completely bombed, gets in a car and kills somebody. Is that murder or manslaughter? Murder, by definition, has to be premeditated. You can't call that murder. I'm not for drunk driving either. But you can't call that murder because it was not premeditated. There has to be this element of premeditation for it to really be murder. And this underlying hostility or hatred that exists. So why would you go out striking anybody with anything? I've lived 50-something years now, and I can't remember too many times where I felt compelled to just beat somebody with a stick. And I find now that I don't even think about that. Maybe I should just get a stick and beat them. I don't think about hitting somebody in the head with a rock or a hammer. I mean, I might think about it, but I don't even think about it. I'll be honest, I don't even think about it. It doesn't cross my mind. Well, if you don't have this underlying hatred and hostility and enmity, you don't think about stuff like that. So again, this is more general. 7, this is a direct violation of the 6th commandment and was to be punished by death. That's 2013. 8, there are times when killing is legitimate and necessary. This is true in the issues of capital punishment, self-defense, and warfare. The Bible allows for all of those. And we even make a distinction, again, between murder and manslaughter, and the element of premeditation has to factor into this. But people, again, in our society are very confused about this. You hear somebody, and we're not ever, I feel bad for anybody that loses a loved one. That's sad. But we've got to have some standards that we go by when dealing with these types of things. And the standards, in my opinion, have to come from the Bible. Otherwise than that, we're just speculating on human viewpoint about what we think might need to be done. This is one of the fundamental good reasons for the Mosaic Law, to define criminal activity and the punishment for it in a righteous society. So 9, the Old Testament made a distinction between accidental killing, no premeditation, no hostility, and provided a different remedy for manslaughter. That was the numbers 35 there, the 10 through 15. Speak to the sons of Israel, and he talks to them about the cities of refuge. You shall select for yourself cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. Now, even if you kill unintentionally and you commit manslaughter, you forfeit a big part of your life under this situation. You got to go to that city of refuge, and you got to stay there for the rest of your life. If you leave it for any reason, you can be killed by the blood avenger. So there, even in accidental killing, it had consequences attached to it. So he may flee there, and the city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. Even the Mosaic Law had the concept of your right to trial before a jury of your peers, as it were, to determine was this killing accidental or intentional. And if it was accidental, it's not treated as the same way intentional killing is treated. And the cities which you are to give shall be your 6 cities of refuge. And you will give 3 across the Jordan and 3 in the land of Canaan. And these 6 cities shall be refuge for the sons of Israel, for the alien and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there. And then he goes into the opposite we just studied. But if it's really murder, it's capital punishment. But because we understand that when people lose a loved one to what people call a tragedy and all of that, that their thinking isn't clear. They want blood. They want vengeance. And you hear them advocate this all the time. We want blood. We're not happy until this criminal's punished. And so God made allowance for this, and he understood human nature and said, well, okay, look, you got to distinguish between accidental killing and premeditated killing. And even in accidental killing, there was a real stigma attached to this. He had to stay in this city of refuge forever. And that's in verse 26. If the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside, the blood avenger kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. because he should have remained in this city of refuge until the death of the high priest. That was when the whole thing kind of got changed over. If the high priest died and there was a change in spiritual rulership, we might say, then all the bets were off on the manslaughter thing. And this was judged by people. You know, it wasn't just the manslayer and the blood avenger got together and tried to hash us out. This was seen as a real legitimate trial. So again, he has to stay there until the death of the high priest. So if that high priest lives another 30 years, well, you're essentially stuck in that city. But you're alive, which, you know, to me meets the opposite. I'd rather be alive than dead. Especially if I committed some, you know, if you kill someone accidentally, you didn't mean to do it. That's the whole idea of accidental killing. 10, the next two vices are sexual in nature and should be understood as a violation of the seventh commandment, which should be understood as banning all sexual activity outside of marriage. Now, in Exodus 20 again, the seventh commandment is general and should be taken first in a general sense. You shall not commit adultery. But this is understood to go beyond just, say, adultery, sex between someone who's married and someone else, and it encompasses all immorality. And this is generally the way the commandment's interpreted. And Paul certainly makes it more general by the use of pornos, which is a more of a general term for immorality. 11, the first term, pornos, immoral, originally was used of one who had sex with a prostitute. It has been broadened and is used in a more general sense to refer to any type of immorality. But the nuance here would be heterosexual immorality. I mean, there's what we call normal perversions and abnormal perversions. The normal perversions are like sex between a man and a woman. Now, if you're not married, it's wrong. It's still a perversion. It's not correct. God's not for it. But then there's the abnormal ones. You know, sex with sheep. Most people consider that bad. Hey, the Bible doesn't say thou shalt not have sex with sheep. It says you shall not have sex with any animal. So there's abnormal perversions. Bestiality, homosexuality, necrophilia, Alice Cooper. These are the abnormal things. I love the dead. Whoo. Well, that's abnormal. That's sick. And you see these abnormal perversions paraded around, and now our society's become so inured to it that the abnormal has now become commonplace. So it's no longer viewed as abnormal. This is a part of holding the line with doctrine. We got to say, you know, hey, no, this is abnormal. No, I don't want to know what you do. I'm not interested. Here you would deal with primarily the normal form of perversion. It's still wrong. It's still wrong to have sex outside of marriage. 12, the next term has occasioned a great deal of debate since the homosexual lobby does not want this term to be translated by the English term homosexual. 13, much of the debate focuses on the fact that the term is only attested in the vice lists of the sort we have here and is not used in other more specific contexts. Even the pro-homosexual lobby has to admit that the Greek corpus of Greek literature that we have, extant Greek literature, not just the Bible, the New Testament, which is written in Greek, but extant Greek literature from writers like Plato and Aristotle and some of these other guys. And all the extant Greek literature doesn't really use this term. And when it is found, it's only found in vice lists. It doesn't, you know, you don't find it in, you know, a term like Frank was a homosexual. It's not just used in narrative literature at all. And anybody that does any serious study on this would have to acknowledge that the only time we find this word in Greek literature is in a vice list. So what vice is it prohibiting becomes the question. Well, again, when you define a word, the first thing you got to look at is the etymology of the word. What does it mean to bed a male? What did Paul have in mind when he said that? And the fact is, one of the things we will see, and I don't know if I put it in the notes or I know I have it in the apologetic, was that some people, interpreters have recognized that Paul probably coined this term, that this term was not attested before Paul. So did Paul make up this word? Because he was trying to communicate a certain concept. Under the filling ministry of the Holy Spirit, he certainly could have. There are a lot of, in fact, as I pointed out in the introduction of this book, there are per capita more hapaxes in first and second in the pastoral epistles than there are in any other writing in the Bible. And Paul had a very distinct, defined vocabulary. Very broad, in fact. One would recognize, if he does any study of the Greek, if you go look at the Greek of John, even in Revelation where you had a lot of anomalies, but you look at John's vocabulary, his sentence structure, the words he uses and all of that, and you compare it to Paul, it becomes immediately apparent that Paul was way more fluent in Greek and had a much broader vocabulary and was much more fluent in writing even than John was. But Paul was a trained professional rabbi with the best education. John was a fisherman. They both could communicate doctrine, but they were very, very different in that regard. So again, they don't want this to be translated as homosexual, and the reality is we have to deal with it anyway. It's still in here. 14 various translations have rendered the term homosexual, sodomite, pervert, abusers of themselves with men, those who defile themselves with mankind, and practicing homosexual. One of the things about Bible Works that's kind of nice is I have access to like 50 different English translations. So I can quickly look and see, okay, well, how did these translators all deal with this word? And one of the things you see in this is that there's some unanimity here. You don't have a lot of these guys saying, well, no, this word meant something completely different. Now, in modern times we do, but here's what they also are doing. And this is true not only in the pro-homosexual approach to this thing, but in religion and theology as well. We are throwing out scholars, quote scholars, beginning with the higher criticism in the 18th and 19th centuries and the rise of that thinking. They have thrown out 1,800 years of church history and interpretation and come up with new and unique spins on all this. That makes me nervous. How did 1,800 years of believers miss this, and now only these guys are getting it? And they tended to be German in their origin. They tended to be rationalists in their thinking. They tended to reject the supernatural. And they tended to come up with new and unique spins on the scripture that only they had figured out. Whereas I look at it and think, well, you know, we got a lot of church history behind us. What has the church? How has this been interpreted over the years by theologians? And what do they say? Well, 15, although the pseudo-scholars do not want to look to the etymology of the word, it is the first place the translator must go when attempting to establish a definition. In that regard, it is a compound of arsane, the word for male, which emphasizes the strength and male aspect of a man, as opposed to the weaker feminine aspects of a woman. And the Greek noun koite, which literally refers to a bed, like it's used for that in just a literal sense of a bed in Luke 11:7, and it's used figuratively to refer to the sexual aspect of the marriage bed. Now, so we look at Luke here, say, and we say, well, the koite can't always be technical because sometimes it just means a physical bed. That's all it refers to. Luke 11:7. And this was in the parable of the guy that didn't want to get up. And from inside he shall answer and say, do not bother me. The door has already been shut, and my children and I are in bed. All he means is they're in bed asleep. So all that means in this context. So, and then here, and it's used of the marriage bed, Romans 13:13. And I did read you the Hebrews 13:4 passage, so we've already looked at that. And in context, it talks about adultery and the marriage bed remaining undefiled. So it's used definitely in a sexual context there. Romans 13:13, let us behave properly, as in the day. Because one of the things you know about, sort of a statement of convention about the human race is, that most people don't get up and begin partying at 9 o'clock in the morning. And they don't do their wild stuff and sow their wild oats. This generally occurs after the day is finished and you move into the period of dark and night time. And that's when, you know, like if you go to Mardi Gras, once the sun goes down, it gets a little kooky. You go to Key West, once the sun goes down, it gets real kooky. And I mean, I've been to 3 county fairs and a hog calling, and I ain't seen some of the stuff I saw down there. It gets very bizarre. But a lot of this deviant activity is reserved for the nighttime. Why? That's normally the way people do it. That's a statement of convention about the human race. So he says, as believers, let us behave properly like it's daytime all the time. Not in carousing and drunkenness. Not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality. Not in strife and jealousy. And I believe in that regard, 13:13, koite is the first one there that's translated by sexual immorality. So, and all it has is the word beds, not beds. So what's Paul saying? Don't go to bed? Ever. No, he's not using it in this context of just a literal bed. He's talking in the context of, and that's obviously proven by the next word with it, asalgaia, which refers to sensuality, sensual conduct. So again, you have to look at the word first, and where did the word come from? What is the derivation of the word? And we know what arsane means, and we know what koite means. We have a compound of these two terms. So 17, the term would then be defined as one who took a male to bed as one takes a wife to bed. 18, this was somewhat common in the Greek culture that recognized several forms of homosexuality as being a normal and accepted part of society. 19, the argument of the gay lobby is that Paul is not condemning homosexual activity with this word. He is condemning sexual exploitation that was very common in the slave trade. And 20, this is based on the fact that the next term in our list deals with the slave trade and the various injustices that were associated with taking others as property. Law legislates against kidnapping. Why? Because law, effectively, what law does is it protects the rights of the individual. That's what it's designed for. We have laws in order to protect all our rights. We all have rights. And so the law is there to protect those rights. I have the right not to be, carjacked in my car and stolen and sold into slavery. God provides that right for us. That's a part of freedom. And everybody has that right. So people that do that clearly have gone well beyond their provision and their rights in life and have then violated the rights of others. Well, again, this is they say, well, okay, he's not condemning homosexual activity here. What he's condemning is the fact that people would take slaves and then exploit them sexually. Now, that doesn't go on today, does it? It's horrific. It's pandemic, in fact. It's a known fact that they will take these young girls in various cultures and sell them off as slaves. And sometimes the family will do it and sell them off as sex slaves. Now, that's gross. That's offensive and horrific to even think about. How do normal people do this? Normal people don't. So they try to make the connection here because the next term does mean kidnapping. And they say, well, this term relates to the next term. My argument is, however, this overlooked the fact that the previous word had a clear sexual connotation. And this term certainly has an etymology that deals with sex between men. 22, the most common interpretation of the two terms that Paul uses in the New Testament for homosexual activity have been understood by Orthodox interpreters to refer to the active and passive partner in male sex. Arsena koites refers to the dominant role in the sexual relationship. And in malakos, which he uses in 1 Corinthians 6:9, literally means soft to the touch and is used to refer to the passive partner in the sex act. And so you recognize that in male sexual, homosexual activity, you have an aggressor and you have the more passive partner. Both are condemned in the Scripture, strangely enough, as you might imagine. So one of the arguments that the pro-homosexual lobby also advocates is Paul is against aggressive forms of homosexual activity by people who will resort to violence in order to fulfill their sexual lust. Well, I would agree that he's against that. But is that the only thing he's against? And I don't think so. I think the word goes well beyond that. So that's another one of their things. Well, this word refers to violent homosexual activity, not just homosexual activity in general. What do they base that on? Well, nothing. They pretty much pull it out of thin air. Because even the pro-homosexual lobby, strangely enough, acknowledges that aggressive homosexuals are dangerous. Is there any other kind? One of the things I figured out pretty early on as a believer was the homosexuals can't reproduce. They have to recruit. That's the only way they can fulfill their deal. That's the only way they can stay in business. You have to recruit. So aren't they by definition aggressive? They have to be. They're not content with just leaving people alone. So again, here, in spite of all modern attempts to undermine the force of these terms, all the Greek lexicon, literally comprising hundreds of years of scholarship, are consistent in their understanding of these two terms. I don't have to go, I can look at Lonida, I can look at Thayer, I can look at BDAG, I can look at any of the classic Greek lexicons that are considered the standards by which we operate as believers, as theologians and as scholars. The standards by which we operate are all very consistent that these words mean this exact thing, what we're saying here. That we're not just making this up because we're somehow against queers. That this is what the words actually mean. So 24, further, this understanding is consistent with the clear teachings of the Old Testament that forbid sexual activity between males and condemn it as an abomination. Leviticus 18:22. And God isn't like some people. Some people throw around the word abomination like everything's an abomination. No, not everything's an abomination. Abomination's a strong term. I mean, there are things I don't like. Watching spelling bees on ESPN. That's one of them. Or trick shot pool. When did this become a sport? But are those abominations? No. An abomination would be something, you know, gay homosexual sex on ESPN. That's an abomination. Not everything's an abomination. Certain things are really considered horribly depraved and detested particularly. Leviticus 18:22. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. Also, you shall not have intercourse with any animal to be defiled with it, nor shall any woman stand before an animal to mate with it. It is a perversion. Why did he say don't do these things? Because this was characteristics of the Canaanites in the land in which they were going. They were a very, very depraved people. And the Jews get all this bad press. Oh, yeah, God, Moses led the Jews out. But look at what they did to those poor indigenous peoples. Those poor indigenous people were scum. They were a blight on the planet that needed to be removed, and God removed them, as God establishes and removes all nations, does he not? Does God not cause the rise and fall of nations? Why did he establish the Jews in the land? To eliminate this type of activity that was rampant with these people. And so Leviticus 18:22, also 20:13, which deals with our same thing. If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act, they shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is on them. So 25, in that regard, a number of commentators have recognized that the two terms, pornos and arsenokoites, are designed to refer specifically to the seventh commandment, which prohibited immorality. Of course, it prohibited specifically adultery, but has been broadened in Paul's thinking here to include immorality of various kinds, normal perversion and abnormal perversion. He sees them both as being bad. So 26, as Moss has stated in the NIV commentary series, while the root of the word is a male sex, the term does not refer exclusively, as some have suggested, either to male homosexuality or to sexual activity with boys. It simply refers to homosexuality in general, which Paul condemns as sin. And also Romans 1:26-27, in that vice list, he condemns immorality of any kind. And Paul condemns it as sin. And again, this is the only place we find these words is in these vice lists. Romans 1:26-27 there. They did not see, for this reason. So because, and this comes out of their religion. Why were the Canaanites such a depraved people? And the Canaanites, I use that term broadly to refer to the Hittites, the Hivites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, and all the little indigenous populations and groups that were in that region. Some named after people, some named after the cities they inhabited, and all that. Why were they so depraved? How did they get that way? They rejected the knowledge of God. Their morality flows out of their religion, or lack thereof. And by religion, I'm using it in a good sense here, of a relationship with God. And how does God want people to live? Well, verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Well, that's bad, isn't it? I think so. And worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And how did they manifest this service of the creature? In sexual depravity. This is how people serve themselves very often, is in the sex act. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions. For their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. You know, I don't want to draw any pictures. I don't have any overlays for this. But certain things fit together. You know, like locks and keys. You know, and that sort of thing. And so there's certain things that don't fit together. We call that unnatural. If it doesn't fit together, it's unnatural. And in the same way, men abandoned the natural function of the woman. What is the natural function of the woman? And burned in their desire toward one another. And now, see, that I just can't get. Hey! You're looking good today, Bob. You been working out? I don't get that. I'll admit, I don't get it. I don't want to get it either. Look out in the congregation, you know. You look pretty, boy. Well, the thing is, you know, they burned in their desire towards one. I just don't see it. I'm sorry. I don't think normal people see it. Men with men. And literally, committing the unspeakable deed is what it says literally from the Greek. Committing the unspeakable deed and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And so some have said that AIDS and all of this is not a judgment from God. I think it's a part of the natural order. It's not, quote, a judgment. It doesn't have to be specifically from God. You violate certain natural laws and you're going to pay the price. You go outside today and violate the law of gravity, and if you're 100 feet off the ground, I ain't going to give you much chance of surviving. Go into an airplane and violate the law of gravity without a parachute. You can't violate certain natural laws. This is why do we put the little outlet things over the deals with the kids in the house? Because we know that they're not smart enough not to violate the natural laws that govern electricity. I think I'll put a penny in. Or whatever, you know, get a paper clip and play with it. You know, so we put little things over it to protect them. Because we know that if they don't understand these laws, they don't understand that a 2,000-pound vehicle will kill you if it hits you, that this is why we don't play in the street, and kids don't understand certain things, so we have to teach them. And these people have violated natural law big time. And look at the kinds of things that have happened to them. And look at the change in their demeanor and their behavior. We all know how normal men act. But then we hear the guys that lift and they're dainty and they swish when they walk and, oh, isn't it, I want to be a male model. I want to design clothes. I feel so good. Oh, please. Men don't act that way. Normal men don't act that way. Men have masculine characteristics. That's part of the maleness. And in your soul, and your soul comes from God, and God unites the soul with the body. There are male souls and there are female souls, as it were. The sexual distinction isn't just in the body, it's in the soul. Men are initiators, women are responders. That's the way God designed them. And so now you got a man who becomes a responder. No thanks. So, but then they want to get around this. I say, well, no, this isn't what the Bible means. And this is very much under attack. And are we going to put these guys in positions of authority where they have access to people? And what are the big crimes that we hear about, all in all told, you know, we've lived in this society long enough. What are the biggest abuses in churches? Isn't it money and sex? Aren't those the two things that make the news? Oh, well, this minister, he embezzled $50,000 and left town with the secretary. We've heard those stories. Jim Baker. You know, these guys out there living high on the hog, you know, skimming money off the deal, making $500,000, $600,000, $800,000 a year. We had, what's his name up there in St. Pete? Lyons. He, you know, had a whole separate house he bought for this woman with church funds so he could keep his mistress. You got to love it. Oh, wait a minute. Or you have to hate it. It's wrong. And so we see what are the... And so we want to put homosexuals, acting, practicing homosexuals in charge of young people to teach them? I don't. Not at all. If I had my way, they wouldn't even be in the school system. But I don't have my way at that regard. Okay, well, time's up. We will stop there and continue on here. I'll send you out the apologetic sometime this week because we won't. We might get to it Wednesday, but maybe not. Make sure you have it so you have time to print it out, though. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen. I need to make one more announcement, too. Next Sunday afternoon.